This talk by Noah Levine was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles, California, and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Okay, I do have a topic tonight. My topic is what in Buddhism, what the Buddha referred to as the five spiritual faculties, sometimes translated as the five powers, spiritual powers. And this teaching comes out of, the Buddha talked about it a lot when people say, how do I get enlightened? You know, often he said, well, you follow the Eightfold Path. But sometimes he said, oh, there's five powers that you have to have for spiritual awakening, for enlightenment, for freedom from suffering, for happiness. And this teaching first occurs in the Buddha's life, in the scriptures of Buddhism, right after the Buddha's enlightenment. If you know anything about the story of Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, he was dissatisfied with his life. He went out to seek the end of suffering. He spent 7 years, a couple of years, studying with the kind of famous spiritual teachers of his time, and then several years off in the forest by himself or with a few friends doing their own thing, doing kind of ascetic practices, self-denial practices. He spent 7 years seeking enlightenment. Eventually, there's the famous story of where he gave up the guru practice, and he gave up the ascetic practice, and he went off by himself and sat under the Bodhi tree and said, I'm just going to sit here until I get enlightened. That's it. That kind of resolve. Enlightenment or death. I'm not going to budge, right? No matter how much my mind says, run, I'm going to deal with it. And so he sat there, and he got enlightened. And whatever that means. It means something like no longer being attached to pleasure, no longer meeting pleasure with craving and greed and attachment. It means something like no longer meeting pain with hatred, radiating compassion towards pain rather than aversion. It means something like this comment, this question of kind of being willing to not have a self to identify with. Something like not suffering, not being self-centered, understanding the impersonal nature of impermanence, the unfolding process of self. So anyways, he came to his awakening, whatever that means. We'll figure that out as we continue to practice, I guess. And then he was a little surprised. It feels like when I've read this scripture over and over, it's a little bit like, okay, I got enlightened. Now what? Right? I've wanted to get enlightened, and I'm seeking enlightenment. And okay, here I am. I'm not suffering anymore. I'm free. I'm awake. This is awesome. But then he said, how did that happen? How the fuck did I get here? And he reflected, and his answer of how he got there and his answer for how we can get there, one of the ways that he answered that question was the five faculties, five powers. He said, the first thing that I had, the first thing that I believe is necessary for anybody on a spiritual quest is faith. Faith also can be considered hope. Faith also can be this term that in Buddhism we call faith, can also be confidence. Sometimes this word faith is confusing because of maybe some of our Western connotations with faith meaning something like a belief in something that you're pretty sure is not true. Right? Sometimes faith has that sort of like believing something, you know, in the talking snake or in the walking on water or, you know, believing something that you don't, you're pretty sure didn't happen. And Buddhism has a little bit of that, but very little. Most of the, what we call faith in Buddhism is verified faith. And just about, I would hope that actually everything that the Buddha taught, he said, you can, it can be experienced directly, that there's no blind faith asked for. So this first faculty of faith isn't, I believed, but it is, I was willing to try. I had some faith or some confidence or some hope that meditation might help me. And so this is thought to be true for all of us and for anybody that does spiritual practice, that there's some faith that brought you here. Faith can come in a lot of different forms. The Buddha, for him, for Siddhartha, pre-Buddha, pre-enlightenment, he met a spiritual practitioner, and it was confidence in what that person was doing that gave him confidence, that gave him some hope, that said, well, I'm going to try that. He looks happier than me. I don't know if it's true or not, but he looks happier than me. And that gave him some faith in spiritual practice. And then he tried it for himself. Had spiritual experience. Verified faith. I think that this is actually very interesting for each of us to reflect on. So reflect for a moment. Remember, what gave you faith? What gave you some hope, some confidence that whatever your initial spiritual practices were, maybe somebody's here for their first meditation ever tonight, but I'd imagine that most of you have been doing some prayer and some meditation and some yoga and whatever else you've been doing. But something brought you to the place of confidence. Whether it was reading Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, you know, 20 years ago, and you're like, wow, I want to try meditation sometime. Or it was seeing the Dalai Lama and saying, he's got something that I want. Or it was, you know, waking up and strapped to the bed in the hospital and saying, I don't know, I just don't want this shit anymore. Or showing up in your first rehab and, you know, going to your first AA meeting, whatever it was for you that gave you some hope, that installed some faith. For me, I think that the first inkling that I can remember was being locked up, being incarcerated, being strung out, being, you know, several felonies, and looking at prison. And getting a phone call and an internal hopelessness that just, first of all, knew, I don't know how to live. I don't know how to be happy. And getting a phone call from my father and him saying, why don't you try meditation? And my dad's a meditation teacher. I've been hearing that shit my whole life. But it was actually confidence or faith in him. Even though I had my issues with my dad, it was some faith in him. When he said, why don't you try meditation? I was like, well, he's a lot happier than I am. He's not strung out on crack. He's not locked up. He meditates. I think meditation is stupid. But he's got something that's working for him that I don't. And so it was actually faith in my father that started me on my spiritual path. On some level, that started me meditating. Also, you know, it was some faith in the guys in the 12-step programs that came in and said, hey, Noah, you know, you're also a junkie, so maybe you ought to try some of this. And it was some confidence in them that, like, oh, these guys are sober and they're halfway cool. Maybe, and they're talking about spiritual practice, maybe I should try that too. What was it for you? What gave you faith? Was it a book? Was it a person? Was it an experience? Marlo?
I think what gave me faith was the first time that I mean, was interested in learning how to meditate because it's part of the 12-step program. It's the 11th step, mm-hmm. is meditation, prayer and meditation. So when I came to Dharma Punks to kind of get some kind of insight on how to meditate, I think the one thing that really stood out to me as far as the Buddhism side of this goes was that at the end of the talk, you mentioned that the Buddha always said, don't believe a word that I say. You know, experience this for yourself. Have your own experience. And I think that you sending the message that we don't have to believe any of this, for some reason it made me feel at ease, mm-hmm. and comfortable with listening. And then I really wanted to listen to more. I was like, oh, okay.
That's quite interesting, right? The lack of requesting your faith gave you faith,
yeah.
right? That's quite, I mean, that's very interesting to see in ourselves. Because they weren't asking me to believe it, it helped me to continue to explore it. Yeah. Although, really, the question for you would go way back to what got you sober and starting to work the steps, because your initial spiritual practice isn't here in the meditation. You had a lot of spiritual practice. Something that inspired you to get off of, you know, to get sober and to... So that's the real beginning. That's what the Buddha's talking about here in faith, the initial practice. What else? Anybody else? Please.
I'm not an AA, but I'm an Al-Anon. Mm-hmm. But I think what got me to faith was, Al-Anon issue actually was with my mother. Someone trying to control you and own you. And I had to, even as a kid, I had to work it through in my head. And it was like, being too close to the opposite of faith, really seeing that, like, that was, like, about masochism and shame and liberative happiness, and then recognizing that in myself, mm-hmm. so that, like, faithlessness is a choice, a self-destructive choice. And so it was just, like, faith and faith. Hmm. Like, faith feels better. So just to decide to have faith and faith. And I guess also because I got so, when I was depressed as a kid, I got so intellectual, like, analyzing. And you get to the bottom of that, you see that reason is bullshit. So then it's like, what if you don't have reason, then you have faith. Mm-hmm. You know, just that the limitations of the human mind kind of led me to faith. Just, I mean, honestly, it's like pain for me to faith. Like, just total seeing the devastation from wanting things or people too hard, and also seeing that that's pushing everything and everyone away.
Yeah. I think that point about the pain is really key. If I were going to make this list of the sort of prerequisites to spiritual awakening, I wouldn't put faith first. I'd put dissatisfaction first. Because first there has to be that core dissatisfaction that then even wants to look for something else. Because if we were satisfied, if we weren't in so much pain, if we weren't, then we had no reason to do spiritual practice. So it's actually the suffering or the pain or the dissatisfaction that is the first step, then followed up by confidence. And I like the word confidence better than faith. Sometimes faith feels like I'm supposed to believe. Confidence is just saying, what, if you think of it that way, what gave me the confidence to try praying or meditating or being of service or generous or compassionate, whatever it was for you, what gave you the confidence to even try it? Last one, and we'll move on.
For me, it was a lot of suffering.
Yep.
I've done some spiritual searches for, you know, enlightenment, outside help, and getting my life better, but nothing really changed until I was desperate and in enough pain to make choices to open up.
Yeah. And out of that desperation, was there a messenger?
Several
messengers.
Just, yeah.
One of them, you took the advice.
Yeah, I was very shut down to all spiritual things. It was a matter of desperation.
So, faith by itself will get you nowhere. Just believing, just having confidence. You can have all of the confidence in the world, Meditation works, right? You can believe it. You can have it tattooed on your soul. And it will get you nowhere if it's not followed up by action. So, first, some confidence. Second, effort. Second, spiritual faculty. Effort, action. Takes work. The Buddha said, first I believed it was possible, and then I tried it. I studied with all the teachers I could find. I dedicated my life's energy to practice. I put a lot of energy and effort into spiritual practices. I took the faith and I applied it. I took the confidence and I did the work. That's so important. There's a lot of people in this world who have some really strong beliefs, really strong faith. Even Buddhists, really strong Buddhists, they believe in the Buddha, they believe in enlightenment, but they don't meditate. Right? Your belief will get you nowhere if you don't follow it up with action. You can believe that generosity is a good thing, but if you're not being generous, you can believe that meditation's a good idea, but if you're not meditating, so second step, action, effort. And there's a lot of different levels to effort. From the Buddhist perspective, it's going to take a lot of effort. The stream is strong. This world that we're living in, fueled by greed, by hatred, by delusion. These bodies that we're living in, fueled by greed, by hatred, by delusion. The effort that it's going to take to transform the angry, fearful hatred tendency to experience of compassion, the effort that it's going to take to meet the craving with non-attachment, with forgiveness, with loving kindness, with letting go, it's going to take some effort. I think that I like the image of the stream, knowing that now that we have confidence, if we have confidence, now we find ourselves in a current. And it takes some effort to go against the current, against the stream. Without effort, or with not enough effort, we're going to continue to float downstream. No matter how much faith we have, we're going to be, you know, in the stream with our faith, watching the suffering unfold. I really believe in meditation, I just don't do it. So effort, incredibly important. I heard one Burmese meditation teacher when asked, how much effort, how much meditation do I need to go, you know, paraphrasing, but to go against the stream, to find some spiritual freedom, to find some happiness, how much effort? He said, to make any progress at all, at least 4 hours of meditation a day. Is that if you're meditating less than 4 hours, if, you know, 2 hours, you're just sort of stopping the stream. Less than that, something like this, you know, an hour. I forget exactly what he said. An hour or so, and, you know, you're only slightly backsliding, you know. Less than an hour of meditation a day, and you're, you know, destined for hell. You know, and not hell, as, you know, but just suffering in our own minds, the hell of our own creation, not fire and brimstone hell. So I don't quite believe that, but I thought it was interesting that he, you know, somebody, a monk who was, you know, a 20-hour-a-day meditation guy, you know, really felt like it takes that much effort, several hours. Personally, I have an issue with that because I don't think, even if you sit still for 4 hours a day, I think that the other 20 hours are perhaps more important. And the mindfulness and the compassionate action and the kindness and the generosity that we walk through our days with, perhaps even more important than the hour of meditation, of sitting still. That it's not about how much meditation, it's about how much kindness can we uncover. How compassionate can we be? How generous? How much of the opposite of greed, hatred, and delusion can we manifest in our lives? And so that's not just on the meditation cushion, although the formal meditation cushion will really, really help. Really, really help us become more kind, become more compassionate, become more generous. So, first faith, then action, effort. And two specific efforts. The Buddha experienced, he said, okay, I had the confidence, I applied a lot of effort. He said there was two things that were the most beneficial, and they were mindfulness and concentration. The second two spiritual powers, the power of mindfulness. Letting go of the future, letting go of the past, present time awareness. Being mindful of the craving now. Being mindful of the aversion now. And choosing to respond in a skillful way, in a wise way to the truth of the present moment. Mindfulness and concentration, and they're connected. The more we're mindful, the more concentration builds. The more we concentrate, the more mindfulness we have of what's happening. Concentration has a very beneficial, penetrating quality. Mindfulness can be very broad, this general understanding of what's happening. Concentration can be very precise. Concentration can let us answer that question of who am I? When we're very concentrated, we can see clearly the impermanent, impersonal, unsatisfactory nature of the present moment. Concentration can help us take it much less personally. So this combination of mindfulness and concentration helps us penetrate the truth beyond the thinking mind, beyond the emotional reactivity. The fifth and final factor, and I'm rushing by this because I'm just about out of time, is wisdom. Now that's a big one, right? Because he's saying, first we have confidence, and then we follow it up with a lot of action. And a lot of that action is meditation action, is mindfulness action, is concentration action. And that leads to liberating insight. That leads to transformative wisdom. And that comes in so many different forms. Perhaps one of the most important aspects of wisdom is the wisdom of compassion. Sometimes in Buddhism we talk about wisdom and compassion as two separate things, but they are not separate. Compassion is a wise action. Compassion is the only wise relationship to pain that is possible. Any other relationship to pain other than compassion is going to perpetuate some level of suffering. Compassion is the wisest response. It's the enlightened heart's response to unpleasant experience. Caring about it. Genuinely caring about pain is compassion. And not just other people's pain, but our own pain. The wisdom that unfolds through mindfulness and concentration is the wisdom of the Buddha when he says, you could search the whole world and never find another being more worthy of your love than yourself. That kind of wisdom. Knowing your worth, knowing you're worthy of love and kindness because you are a sentient being, not because you're special, not because you're separate, but because we are interconnected. The flip side of that wisdom is that there's nobody less worthy of your love and kindness either. Starting to understand that we're not as separate as we thought. That everyone wants to be happy. Everyone deserves to be happy. And the wisdom that also shows us that everyone's happiness depends on their own actions, not our wishes for them. What we call equanimity in Buddhism. Mindfulness and concentration, wisdom begin to help us be less codependent, less controlling, genuinely compassionate, without, I need you to stop suffering because it makes me really uncomfortable. Right? Please, stop suffering. I can't tolerate it. So equanimity is the wisdom that your suffering will end when you respond with compassion, not when I respond with compassion. My compassion will not end your suffering. Only yours will. Only your action. Wisdom, I said it a couple times tonight, in Buddhism, three main things we are looking for. And not Buddhism, but you know, in this world. Understanding impermanence and coming into harmony with it. Everything is changing all of the time. You can't stop it. Stop trying. Everything is an unfolding process, including you. Including us. An unfolding process. Impermanence is your experience with the pain tonight. It arises, it passes. Impermanence is also our experience with the pleasure. It arises, it passes. If we try to hold on to pleasure, we suffer. It gets pulled beyond our grasp. If we meet pain with aversion, we suffer because we can't avoid it. Wisdom that comes out of the effort of spiritual practice is understanding impermanence and coming into harmony with it. The wisdom that comes out of the mindfulness and concentration of the Buddha is not taking it so personal. Beginning to see through meditation, my mind does whatever it wants. Ultimately, you start not taking it so personal. It's not even my mind. It's yours. It's the mind instead of my mind. It's just a human mind, conditioned by experience, fueled by ego. It's not personal. It's everybody's mind. It's the universal mind. It's a mind that has evolved to survive, not a mind that has survived, that has evolved for happiness. I think that that's really important, and I think a lot of people don't like this aspect of Buddhism, which is that actually happiness is not your birthright. You don't get to be happy just because you were born. You don't inherit happiness just because you took a human rebirth. You have to work for it. Actually, being born into samsara, this human realm, it doesn't guarantee happiness. Actually, it guarantees suffering. For sure. You have a body with a nervous system, you're going to suffer. It's going to hurt. And you're going to crave pleasure all the time, and you're never going to get enough pleasure. It's impossible. And you're going to hate pain, and you're going to be met with a whole bunch of pain that you don't want. And you're going to suffer. Happiness comes when we transform, when we do the hard spiritual practice of saying, okay, I can't get rid of the pain. I better start meeting it with compassion. I better choose wise action. okay, I can't hold on to pleasure. I better let go. I better learn to appreciate it, to enjoy it without clinging to it. This is the wisdom that the Buddha had. This is the wisdom that comes from faith and effort and mindfulness and concentration. This is the wisdom of enlightenment. And again, I don't really like to define enlightenment. We'll see. As we continue to be mindful and we continue to investigate our own minds and bodies and process, you'll find out what enlightenment is if you keep at it, rather than having faith in someone else's definition. The most important kind of faith is the direct experience, is the verified faith. You'll find out for yourself. Only a few minutes left, but any clarifications about what I'm saying? Any questions? Is it somewhat clear?
You said three things important, and then I just got
one. Oh, that's right. Well, I kind of did the other two. Impermanence, impersonal, or anatta, not self, and unsatisfactory. That you won't find satisfaction in impermanent pleasure. You won't find satisfaction in pain. Stop looking for satisfaction in the material. So the sort of the Buddha's language, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Impermanence, not self, and suffering. Or impermanence, impersonal, and unsatisfactory. These are three truths, three core truths. It's important to come back to that first place of faith, to remind ourselves what our original aspirations and motivations are. Sometimes it can really help us continue with the effort. Continue against the current, against the stream. Yeah, last one.
When you were talking about that Burmese monk, it just sort of, for me personally, because I have a tendency to be kind of fanatical, and I've had, you know, I've had experience with other places, other kind of spiritual disciplines where you can get really kind of out of balance with your culture, and I just was wondering if you wanted to clarify your thoughts on what appropriate practice is for, you know, for regular people.
I think a half hour a day of formal practice is a good place to start. I think that that's not imbalanced. I think that's really possible. I think after some time, it's good to increase to about an hour a day, whether that's sitting for 1 hour and actually kind of doing a longer or 2 30-minute periods, or moving to kind of a 45-minute formal practice in the morning and then doing some 15 minutes before bed or something. As far as for us, for us householders, I also think that it's incredibly important to take a time regularly and go off on retreat. There's only so much that we can do in our busy daily lives, but to go and spend a week or 2 weeks in a silent meditation retreat environment will really help your insight. It will really help your practice deepen. So I think that that's important for us. Formal practice, really, really important. Informal practice, the way we treat each other, the way we treat ourselves, the generosity, the kindness, the forgiveness, really, really important. They both feed each other. You know, you can't just be a good meditator but be an asshole. And you can't just be an asshole but be a good meditator. You know? So it's both. It's really both and. How we treat each other, how we treat ourselves. And meditation helps us get there. Okay, enough for tonight. Thank you all for your reminded me, as I sometimes say, don't believe it. Find out for yourself, especially a list like this. Really good, reflect on it. Does it match up with your experience? Find out for yourself what's true.